Want to be a part of the conversation? Then let us know on the TNT Radio Interactive Live chat room at tntradio.live. Lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's news talk, TNT Radio. Patrick Henningsen and TNT.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, all right, thank you for joining us. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. You're listening to TNT, today's news talk, and boy, do we have a action-packed, powerful broadcast for you today on TGI Friday, and welcome to everybody around the world, whatever time zone you're in, especially the lunchtime crowd on the East Coast of the United States, and also late afternoon in the UK and Europe, and of course the late shift, actually getting up early, the Jocko Winkelink crowd who gets up at 4 a.m. and goes and hammers it with a run on the beach down in Brisbane, Australia. If you guys are up, hello to you, and thank you for tuning in to this live broadcast, and also for downloading the TNT Radio app on Apple Play, Apple Store and Google Play. That's the best way to listen to this network and catch all these 20-something great hosts and shows and the podcasting archives. It's all there at your leisure, at your fingertips here at TNT Radio internationally and globally. Now, we're going to be joined in the first hour by a very special guest, a filmmaker who's made some very impactful films. Most recently about related to COVID, but about this issue of end-of-life drugs, midazolam, and others in this sort of category. We'll call it euthanasia, but we'll call it a stealth euthanasia policy. Certainly, this has been a big controversy in the UK. We're going to be joined by Jackie Devoy. She's a filmmaker, and she's got that project, which has done very well over the last year and a bit, and also a new project she wants to talk about. But in general, she is an incredible journalist who's got a great story. I mean, how this story came about itself is a story. So we'll touch on that in the first hour. And later in the second hour, we'll be joined by our legal correspondent, Matthew Russell Lee, at the Southern District of New York, the federal court steps there, and also the United Nations. These are his two beats, as it were, although he's been shut out of the UN for exposing scandals at the highest levels of the United Nations. Nonetheless, he still has great contacts and great insights as to what's really going on at the UN level. But there's so much going on the federal court level and the various scandals that are cycling through New York City, that particular district. This is where it all happens. If you follow U.S. news, all the big cases end up there. Matthew's right there inside to give us the inside scoop, and also what he's doing, what he's personally doing, filing motions to unseal and things like this, just basically greater transparency. So we're very honored and pleased to be able to check in with him on a regular basis. So looking forward to doing that in the second hour. In the first part of this show, now we want to hit a couple of really big stories, important stories. Obviously, there's moves afoot right now in the U.S. to lift COVID restrictions. The sort of state of emergency, Biden's filed this, and they said it's going to be in May. I don't understand why they can't just lift it now. Hence, I'm very suspect of this announcement that, oh, we're going to lift the state of emergency, even though there's no pandemic happening. Actually, there never was, truth be told. But why forecast ahead 3-4 months and say, oh, we'll do it then? We'll do it then. These are unpopular restrictions. They're being thrown out of every appeals court case talking about vaccine mandates. And the fact that there's only a couple of countries in the world that don't allow foreign nationals to enter the country unless they've submitted to an experimental pharmaceutical gene jab, aka the vaccine. U.S. is one of them. Pakistan's the other. Yemen, and there's a couple of others. You know, it's just like that's who the U.S. is keeping company with. Why? Need the state of emergency, though, as Freddie Ponton has exposed up at 21st Century Wire. These are medical or biological warfare countermeasures. This is how the government's treating the whole emergency. It's how they treated it from the beginning. It's why there's a massive liability shield, a absolute Fort Knox of a liability shield protecting the government, the pharmaceutical companies, and everybody else along the supply chain. Okay, and so lifting that could potentially allow this legal loophole to be exploited that they've managed to close by making it an emergency, emergency use authorization, etc. So countermeasures, biowarfare. This is what all it's all about, folks. Now, if you think about it, there's a lot of propaganda being pushed at the same time. Think of it, nothing is a coincidence in politics. Just as they're talking about lifting the so-called emergency, a joke. It's a joke. Should never have been a state of emergency invoked. That's what governments do to accumulate and centralize power. But just as that conversation's happening now, what else is happening? There, you see a lot of mainstream outlets now, a lot of government pushing this lab leak theory, okay? Lab leak. This was an engineered virus. It was genetically modified. It was this, that, and the other. And it was more infectious. And really pushing this hard. And it came out of Wuhan. And Fauci was involved and all the rest of it. You have to understand when you're being played. Lab leak is a red herring. If you believe in lab leak, I repeat this for people. This is hard to follow, by the way. This is double, reverse, triple-layered psyop propaganda. Okay, think about what went down in 2020, what went down after that. This is biblical. It's global. So don't think they don't have a back story already arranged as a red herring, a cul-de-sac to draw people into a dead end. Lab leak is a dead end. Gain of function is a dead end. There is no, they'll never produce any evidence for it because it doesn't exist. Gain of function is a theoretical. It's a theoretical idea in the world of virology, which virology is a theoretical science. Virology is not a practical science. If it was practical, they could show evidence that these viruses exist, that SARS-CoV-2 had been isolated and purified and shown to be a biological organism in nature or whatever. No, they can't do that. They need to use genomic sequencing, which is fancy computer modeling, okay, made up on the computer. And so this is how lab leak, this whole idea of lab leak in the theoretical realms can promulgate. And the media love it. There's a lot of technology attached to it. And they think, oh, wow, this is just really complicated. We need to bring in the experts. And the experts can't even tell you how it works. The whole thing is an absolute con. And this whole section of the biopharmaceutical industrial complex goes hand in glove with pharmaceutical products, with so-called mRNA vaccines, okay? They provide the evidence, they create it on the computer, and then they provide the solution, which is either injectable or you swallow it, or they'll spray you with it or whatever. This is what these industries have been doing for over 100 years. And it's no different now. Just now it's got a very fancy geopolitical element attached to it, i.e. Wuhan lab leak, gain of function, SARS-CoV-2 supervirus, jumped from a pangolin to a bat to the Wuhan wet market and then back into the lab and back out to the wet market and then did a world tour in 14 days, went to everywhere, including Fiji and Botswana and, the Yukon Peninsula, Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico and Alaska. I mean, what a joke. And it spread on airplanes and, you know, lightning speed and, you know, the cases popping up everywhere. The cases were PCR tests. Okay, or lateral flow tests. Those are your cases. No virus. There's no live biological sample at all. They took one sputum sample from Wuhan. It was a pneumonia patient. That was patient zero. That was ground zero of the so-called pandemic in January 2020. But what was in that sputum sample? They never isolated or found SARS-CoV-2 or any virus. What they did was use PCR to find nucleotides that when they downloaded the model of it matched the model they had on the gene bank, a 90-something percent match to SARS-CoV-1, which itself was a computer-constructed genomic sequence. So they're using one computer sequence to match another computer-generated sequence and claim that's evidence that a virus exists in the snot of this poor Chinese guy that was dying of pneumonia in Wuhan. And by the way, there's been a pneumonia problem in Wuhan for years. It's got the lowest air quality in the world, second only maybe to Northern Italy. Hint, hint. you see how this is shaping up? Just asking people to think a little bit more, think a little bit harder before you jump on board with the next propaganda juggernaut. And that's exactly what is happening right now. We're being sucked into a lab leak fantasy land cul-de-sac. And the end result of this will be U.S. presidential campaign. Donald Trump and all the Republicans will be in a competition to see who can blame China the hardest for destroying the global economy because they engineered a virus. Okay. That was what EcoHealth Alliance was all about. That's what NIH funding was all about. They created a trapdoor that the Chinese sadly got duped. And by the time this thing has gotten out of control, they can't put the genie back in the bottle. The genie is not the virus. The genie is the idea of a super duper virus. Because at the end of the day, China is as much ensconced in modern pharmaceutical and virology computer magic as Europe is, as the United States is. But governments all around the world agree that they'll use that crisis to tighten up controls of speech, movement, borders, social control, economic control, and they all did it. They all did it. They used it. This is what governments do. Never let a good crisis go to waste. Let's take a break here with TNT, today's news talk. I'm Patrick Hanks, your host, back on the other side with filmmaker Jackie DeVoy. Looking forward to this conversation. We'll see you in a few.
Rick Mudd on TNT Radio.
Boris Johnson said Putin threatened him with a missile strike phone call in February 2022. So now we have Boris Johnson crawling back into out of the woodwork, saying that Putin phoned him up last year and threatened to strike him with a missile. And the question is being asked, well, why didn't he bring it up last year? Why is he only bringing it up now? Why is this only becoming a thing right now? And of course, it's planned that way. It's planned that way to heighten tensions and escalate the situation in Ukraine, which after a year should have been de-escalated by now, at least diplomatically tackled by now. But no, they're sending in tanks now and they're calling for F-16s. And why don't, Zelensky, if you're listening, I know you're listening. Okay, I know you're a fan of TNT Radio. Why don't you just come straight out with it and say, nuke them. Because that's what you really want, isn't it? You little floater. I'm going to try not to get too worked up. He triggers me something shocking.
Rick Mann is locked and loaded on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702. Or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
You're with Patrick Henningsen on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, everybody, welcome. Thank you for rejoining us in the first hour here on TNT, today's News Talk. And before the break, we were sort of breaking down this whole, you know, state of emergency situation, emergency use authorization of various, you know, pharmaceutical products, be they prototypes, experimental, etc. Governments have been using this crisis to do absolutely extraordinary things that they would never be able to do, including public health bodies, including healthcare providers. It's just been a free-for-all since the so-called pandemic began in 2020. And the problem continues. The problem persists. One of those issues is pharmaceutical drugs. We're talking about end-of-life drugs. We're talking about the issue of euthanasia. You probably heard, if you follow UK news over the years, this concept of the Liverpool pathway. This has always been something simmering under the surface of the institutions that see certain ways to expedite the life of certain people that are under their care, i.e. older, elderly people as well, who maybe are not in a position to make the decisions that they might do to avoid such a fate. But one of the people that's been researching this, a journalist, her name is Jackie DeVoy, and she's also a filmmaker. She's made a very impactful film, which has done very well over the last year or so. It's called A Good Death, and it was a co-production with Iconic TV, and they're a great organization as well in Britain, but I think we have her on the line right now. Hello, Jackie.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you for having me on the show.
It's our pleasure. And, you know, this is a big story, obviously, and you're one of the first people to tackle it properly. I mean, to put a documentary film together that really shows how deep this goes and how absolutely evil, really, this whole concept is within the healthcare systems, and not just in Britain, yeah, in Canada as well, as we've seen in recent news. But What's really extraordinary is I had a chance to talk to you last week at the Comcast event, and what I'd like to start is, you know, you've been working on this story for a while. You actually wanted to pitch this story yourself, being a former journalist working for some top publications, and yeah, tell us the story of how you got the idea of this story, and then how you tried to put it together. And then what happened, or the resistance you got, and then what you did as a result independently?
Yeah. I talk about all this in the film, actually, and how I got to be where I am today. So it started at the beginning of 2021 when a man approached me saying that his relative of his had been murdered in hospital. And I thought, well, this is a bit unbelievable, but I'll talk to him anyway. We had a chat, then we met up. And he brought me basically incontrovertible evidence that this had actually happened to his loved one in hospital. So I then thought, well, this is bizarre. What's going on here? And I started speaking out and found a few other people with similar stories. But by the time I'd reached about 20 people with similar tales, because more people were coming to me, the more I put the word out there, and through other people, the more shocking it was. So I thought, well, there's something going on here. So I started looking into it, got some more information together, and contacted 28 editors on mainstream national newspapers in the UK. And for the first few days, it was very quiet, nothing happened. Then one replied, said he was out of the office, get back to me. Then another replied, said they'd pass it on to someone else that might be able to deal with it. Eventually, I managed to arrange two meetings with two editors on national papers, face-to-face meetings. Each meeting lasted about 4 hours, and I brought the original guy with me with a huge file of evidence and copies for the editors to take away with them. To start with, they were a little bit incredulous, thinking, you know, well, this sounds a bit extreme. By the end of the meeting, their jaws were on the floor, literally. And I was saying to them, this is a huge story. And they agreed that it was a huge story. And I said, if you were to run it, and I hope you will, which page of the paper would it be on? And they said, well, it's headline news. It's massive, this story. So I'd called it the COVID death pathway, because what we discovered is that people were being killed in hospital, not just elderly, like you mentioned a minute ago, but people of, say, 50 and over were being killed. And these people weren't necessarily at end of life. They didn't have terminal illnesses and all this was going on. And it was under the guise of a COVID protocol. So if a person went into hospital presenting with COVID-like symptoms, or let's say, because whether COVID exists or not is another matter, but with respiratory issues, they would then be put on this care pathway, which basically was the Liverpool care pathway in disguise. Now, that was implemented a long while ago and was actually banned in 2014 for being inhumane, because they would actually um, put end-of-life patients on nil by mouth, so no water, no food, take away any of the medications that they might be depending on, and just let them die. And this was deemed to be barbaric. In 2014, it was stopped, except it wasn't stopped. It's been carrying on, but under different names. I think one of the names they called it after that was the gold standard framework, something like that. It sounded a bit more palatable. And now, then in 2020, it was brought in as a COVID protocol. So they were actually putting people coming in with COVID or respiratory issues onto this death pathway, calling it a care pathway, and people were dying. So it's been going on, it's still going on now. So I put all this to the editors, and like I said, these two were interested to start with. Then the days went by. I said at that point I had 16 people who were willing to speak out about their own personal story. They were relatives of victims. They were happy to be identified, photographed, anything, because they were desperate to get justice for their loved ones who had been murdered. So one of the editors actually spoke to, I think, four of those case studies on the phone. So he spent a bit of time on it over the next few days. The other one just said he was too busy, he was passing it on to someone else, and that they'd be in touch. And I phoned a few more times and nothing. And then the one who did actually interview some of the case studies, stopped answering my calls, stopped replying to my emails, just completely silent. And so I carried on pursuing these editors. They were the only two that I actually met up with. And it got to a point, and I started doing radio and TV interviews on alternative media as well. Obviously, the mainstream weren't interested, although I did try. And I'd never done anything like that really before. A couple of TV things back in the 90s, but nothing since then. So I was a bit nervous, but I forced myself to do it. And probably have done about, I don't know, maybe 50 or more now. So it got to a point where I just thought, they're not going to publish it. Something weird's going on. There's some kind of denotice or something, you know, or some kind of ban on them even discussing this. So I just thought, I need to do something with it, though. And then Jamie got in touch with me from Iconic and said, let's make it into a film, because he'd heard my story, you know. And so we made A Good Death. And that was that premiered in December 2021. So we did it all really quickly. And it's been seen, I would say, by hundreds of thousands of people now, because it's out. It's on Iconic still. And other people have put it out on various platforms like Rumble and BitChute and so I think a lot of people have seen it now. And once you watch that film, you cannot deny that this is happening. You know, we've done a lot of research, a lot of investigation, spoken to a lot of people. I set up a support group for the original people that were involved in the film. So there were like 12 initially that I interviewed. We've now got nearly 70 in that group. So these are people who kind of, you know, want to be involved with a support group. I've spoken to hundreds of other people who just can't cope with anything after what's happened, and they just can't, you know, be involved in anything like that. It's too much. Some people join the group and have to leave because it's people, so many people telling their stories of the dreadful things that have happened. A woman joined a couple of weeks ago because her dad was in hospital in that very situation. They were trying to kill him, and her family weren't on her side. So she joined the group to get some advice and support, and eventually he was killed. He was killed just, I think, 2 days ago. And she said she had to leave the group because she just couldn't do anything at the moment. She was so distraught, you know. So people handle it in different ways. But one thing that all the relatives and loved ones of the victims have in common is that they can't grieve, because they can't grieve until they get justice. And they also, the other thing they have in common is a huge amount of guilt, because a couple of the people in the group even knew what was happening. Well, like this woman who joined recently, but prior to that, they knew what was happening and they couldn't stop it. And so they feel terrible guilt, you know, because they didn't do what they thought they should have done, even though a lot of them tried their absolute hardest. It's almost impossible. And the sad thing is, as well, in that time, my dad suffered from a minor stroke in August 2021 while we were actually out doing the filming. He was in hospital. And he was actually, he died very suddenly in his bed once he was home after paramedics had come to visit him because he was having a bit of trouble. And the paramedics came and they injected him with something and he died about half an hour after they did that. So my view is that he had a fatal reaction to whatever it was they injected him with. They lied about what they gave him. They first said they didn't give him anything. I gave that to the police to investigate. But again, they, you know, I think they all kind of close ranks in these situations when there's hospitals, paramedics, doctors, coroners, police. This is what I found with people in the group as well, that they don't get anywhere. They just either go around in circles for years or they just keep hitting brick walls and they don't get any help. And then, like I say, the ranks close down and there's nothing to see here. And so same with my dad. After 8 months, the police just said, we're closing the investigation because there's nothing to see here, basically. There's nothing more to investigate. They haven't investigated at all. But it's very difficult. So I don't really know for sure what happened to my dad, but I do understand how these people feel having had that happen, and there's no closure and there's no justice, and they can't. The other thing they have in common is that before they joined the group, they thought they were alone and nobody would listen to them, and that everybody thought they were imagining it and that they'd gone mad, you know, saying all these things. So yeah, it was quite traumatic, really, making the film and hearing all the stories. But I think once you see the film, I don't know if any of your listeners have seen it, there's no questioning it. There's no doubt at all. Even people I know who've said this is ridiculous, this can't be happening, watched the film and were like, oh my God, and also started to realise that maybe it happened to their mum or maybe it happened to their granddad. So. Sorry, I'm talking a lot. I need to let you speak.
No, sure. I'm glad you laid all that out, Jackie. It's very important. I think it's also something for people to understand as well, that as a journalist or a filmmaker, when you take up a story, or in this case, it's more than a story, isn't it? It's an issue. When you take up an issue, you become a lightning rod or a sort of a beacon of hope for a lot of people that can coalesce. But you know, you have to hold that space. You got to hold that platform. That's part of it, and it's a lot more than just making a documentary. I mean, you're getting involved. This happens with a lot of other very touchy subjects as well. Journalists who cover them, you end up covering it for life, don't you? It's not just you're in and out, right?
Well, you make friends with these people, you know, and I speak to them all in the group pretty much every day, and I know them all personally. Well, it feels like I do, and I've met a lot of them now as well. And you want to help them, but I do sometimes get mixed up with who's who and whose story is what, you know, the more people that have been joining. And I feel really bad that I have to get them to remind me sometimes, which one are you again, you know. And also, you know, people are very distressed and they call you, and they call you all times of day and night. You know, I sometimes get messages at 2 a.m, you know, or 4 a.m. sometimes, because they need to speak to someone. And I kind of hadn't really signed up for that, but it comes with this particular issue, like you said, in this particular investigation, that you can't not help people. But it obviously can be very draining, especially when you're going through grief yourself, you know. So it can be difficult at times, but sometimes I just want to say, look, I don't want to do this anymore. I've been doing it for nearly 2 years now, and I'm tired and I need to do something else. Prior to the last 3 years, I was doing much more lighthearted kind of stuff. You know, I was doing human interest stories, the mainstream papers and women's magazines. They'd buy my stories. I used to write for a lot of spooky magazines, ghost stories, do horoscopes and quizzes. You know, it was all quite, because I kind of deliberately wanted to do that because I didn't want to be stressed, you know, and deal with all this heavy stuff. But at the start of 2020, March 2020, I thought, I certainly was obviously interested in what was going on and got drawn into all this stuff and looking into what was really happening in the world. And one thing led to another, and I ended up making this film. So, and it's not stopping there either, because through the people I've met, I've decided to make another film and look at it, the whole thing, in a much more broad sense. So the film I'm making next, well, we've actually finished the filming. We have to start the editing now. I'm crowdfunding this one myself. Iconic might get involved at some point, but that's not been confirmed yet. But so we've crowdfunded the filming. That's all done. And we're now doing phase two of the crowdfunding to raise some funds for the editing, which will probably take another few months, I would say. And then we hope to get the film out there probably in the summer. And that this is called Playing God, and it's about medical democide in the UK over the last 50 years or so. So democide is death by government protocol. So we're looking at all kinds of things. It's not just the Madazlan murders, as they've been called. It's we're covering, you know, drug trials, people who died in experiments, and yeah, all manner of things. And we're covering all different ages as well. So one lady, her baby was killed in hospital, and that was like 20 years ago. Another lady called Joan Bye, her daughter was unwittingly and unwillingly part of a drug trial, or Epilim, which was an epilepsy medication, and she died as a result. She was 12. And Joan has been fighting for justice since then. This was 1978 when it happened, and you know, that woman will be in her 50s now. And Joan has been fighting for 50 years, you know, to get justice, and hasn't got it yet. So this is the problem with these kind of cover-ups, because people, on the one hand, want to get justice and don't want to stop fighting, and in a lot of cases can't stop fighting. They just can't. It becomes their whole life. And you see a lot of them getting nowhere. What we need is a precedent to be set, and once that happens, I think it will snowball then, and everyone will you know, be able to, you know, get some justice. And this is what everyone wants. They just want justice, and so then they can grieve, you know, in and kind of accept that what's happened. Or, well, I don't think they'll ever accept it, but I think they'd feel better for knowing that justice has been done. But as yet, it hasn't been.
We got a couple minutes left before we're going to break at the 40 minute mark here with TNT. But before the break, I wanted to get your sort of ideas on midazolam. Is one of those medications that a lot of people are now aware of as a result of your reporting and other people that have been, you know, taking this you know, bull by the horns, as it were. There's actually quite a lot of evidence. It seems that the government was stocking up on this.
Yes.
Around the time of the pandemic, before or during. So they're more than usual. Did you find that in your research?
Yep. So back in March 2020, a huge order was made for midazolam for about 2 years' supply. They already had 1 year's supply in stock, and they made this huge order from a factory in France. And that's obviously questionable. It's like, well, what were they going to be using that for? And they used it all up in, I think, in the space of 9 months, that 2 year supply. So the we think that the first spike of COVID deaths in April 2020 was down to midazolam murders. Now, you know, I think it does all point in that direction. Midazolam is a benzodiazepine. It's a sedative, and it's generally used for people who are suffering from very serious seizures or have serious epilepsy. It's also used as a sedative in minor operations. It usually makes you forget. It's in the same group as verihypnol and those sort of drugs, and it has been used as a date rape drug as well, midazolam. So it not only knocks you out and makes you forget, but it overdose of it will kill you, especially when combined with morphine, which is an opioid. And these two drugs, and it says in all pharmaceutical journals, those two drugs, benzodiazepines and opioids, should never be used together, because they depress the respiratory system so much that it eventually stops breathing. That combination of drugs, that killer cocktail, is used on death row for executions. So the fact that they're giving frail, usually frail and usually elderly people, though not always, these drugs in high doses, the same drugs that they're giving to murderers and rapists on death row, it's beyond belief, really, that they're actually and it's obviously going to kill them. And I think you know, this has been known from the start that these killer drugs are actually euthanizing people. And the thing about euthanasia as well, euthanasia is murder. I don't even know why there is a word euthanasia, because it's murder. And if you euthanize someone, if you kill them, you get the same jail sentence as you would for murder. If you assist someone with their suicide, you'll get a jail sentence as well. It's illegal in this country. And this was something that I found when I was talking to the editors of the papers. They, one of them in particular, said it's not really a story, because we know that this happens all the time in hospitals. And when someone's very old and terminally ill, they do get a helping hand. And I said, that's the story. People are being killed every day in hospital and in care homes and in hospices. And that is the story. And the final thing I wanted to say about it is that I've spoken to people whose loved ones were in their 50s. In my group alone, there's five people whose loved ones were in their 50s and they were not terminally ill and they weren't at the end of life. Or even if they were, that's no reason to kill them. But absolutely horrendous stories. One woman who's a nurse herself, her 54-year-old husband was killed while she had her arms around him. He was unconscious in the hospital bed. He went into hospital with suspected chest infection. Then they starved him and they didn't give him any fluids. He was dehydrated. He was a big man, 54 years of age. They injected him while she was visiting him and he died in her arms. This is just one of hundreds of stories I've heard over the last couple of years. It makes absolutely horrendous. And the newspapers are still not running it. I've told them all they're now complicit. They've got blood on their hands and that they are now part, they're now involved and responsible to a large degree for the killings that are continuing.
Yeah, accessories to a bigger crime. I'm talking with journalist Jackie Devoy, and also filmmaker of A Good Death. Trailblazer Films is the production company. Jackie, if you can stick around after the break, I have a few more things I'd like to put to you.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's so many things, questions that have popped up as a result of what you just said. So I want to try to get through some of that on the other side.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
So listen, folks, you want to stick around. We'll be back after these messages with TNT Today's News Talk.
Deweaponizing weather with reality and perspective.
What is baffling to me is how the meteorological community of the world, knowing what different sea surface temperature profiles can do, the relationship between warm sea surface temperatures in one place and cool in another, and the hemispheric pattern, be it the northern hemisphere or the southern hemisphere, why is it there's not more curiosity about this? Now, I'm looking at the sea surface temperatures right now, and of course, they're considerably warmer than 30 years ago. And I wish I could show you, but it is boiling warm southeast of Africa, southeast of Australia, right around New Zealand. That's gotta be record warm water right around New Zealand, southeast of South America. Now, what is causing that type of warm water in those areas? Is it some kind of magic CO2 fairy? And why is the warm water in these areas? Why doesn't the CO2 fairy put it someplace else? These are very, very puzzling questions. I would hope that the meteorological community would take a look at these sea surface temperatures and ask themselves that. This is TNT Climate and Weather Watchdog meteorologist Joe Bastardi asking you to enjoy the weather. It's the only weather you've got.
Are our love bugs and companions. They are our pets, our family, and they make life better. When we face unexpected challenges, so do our pets. That's why we're on a mission to support people and their pets. Whether donating a bag of kibble, sharing an Instagram post of a lost cat, or welcoming a foster pet into your home, every bit of kindness counts. Visit petsandpeopletogether.org to learn how to be a helper in your community. Brought to you by Maddie's Fund, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Ad Council.
Political commentator and investigative journalist. You're with Patrick Henningsen on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, folks. Thank you for rejoining us here in the first hour. I'm Patrick Henningsen. You're listening to TNT, Today's News Talk. We've got a very important conversation that we're doing right now with our guest. She's a journalist. She's also a filmmaker. Her name's Jackie DeVoy. The film is A Good Death, and it's only the first of hopefully many productions. There's another one coming out, which she is also working on. She's crowdfunding. We'll give the crowdfunding sites a shout out at the end of this segment, Jackie. But, you know, Jackie, what you just said is really disturbing. And, you know, we've all had, if you're in the UK, we've all had some brush with this in one way or another, either through friends, family, or friends of friends and their family. And what do you think about this? Because the other thing that was, you mentioned midazolam and these other killer cocktails, as you call them. This idea of forcing people onto ventilators, which was rife at the beginning of the so-called pandemic, March, April, May of 2020, and ventilators are not innocuous. I mean, these are, you need to do a chemically induced coma to get you onto a ventilator, to intubate, as they say, and then... Yeah. People are in the UK, and I have personal experience with this. We're told to, before surgery or before the ventilator, to sign a DNR order. Do not resuscitate. Yeah. Otherwise, they won't be given the care. And they were isolated from their families during COVID because the wards were sealed off. So there's a lot of people that were totally unable to, and then it got worse with the vaccine mandate, because if the families weren't vaccinated, they couldn't go into the care home or the hospital to be with their family. So you had all of these layers to isolate the patient. What is your feeling on this ventilator issue? Because I think this might have strongly contributed to the, quote, COVID death numbers at the beginning of the crisis.
Absolutely. So a lot of people were put on ventilators unnecessarily, put in positions that they shouldn't have been in. And this a double whammy effect of, they were given, like you said, they had to be put into a chemically induced coma before they could be put on the ventilator. It's not just a matter of opening your mouth and swallowing a tube. So one of those drugs that would be used for that sedation would be midazolam. So you've got the possible overdose of midazolam. And the other thing is, all titration seemed to have stopped. Because when you're naive to a drug, for example, if you've never had midazolam before, they need to titrate. They need to give you a tiny little bit first. They're supposed to start at 0.1 milligram and then maybe go up to 0.5 if it's not working, like they do in the dentist. They don't whack you with a whole load of, 10 milligrams of something before trying it out on you first to see how you react to it. Some are fine with half a milligram, some need a bit more. So someone who is elderly and frail needs a lot smaller dose. But what they were doing with this new protocol, this new COVID protocol, was recommending 2.5 milligrams straight away of midazolam and 2.5 of morphine as well, if I remember that correctly, but much higher dose than they should be giving to people, especially elderly, frail people. And that was enough to kill some people immediately. What a lot of people were given was a syringe driver, which is like a pump. So it will continuously pump those drugs into your body. Now, the average amount of time it takes to kill an average sized person with this method is 29 hours. Some people will die immediately from it. I've known people who have had the one injection and die immediately. Like my dad, they said they didn't give him midazolam. They said it was nothing. Then they said it was something else. And I don't know. I really don't know. And some people last for a long time on it. So the nurse I mentioned earlier, her husband, 54 years old, 120 kilograms in weight, big man. She wasn't allowed to see him for 11 days. When she saw him, he'd been not been given any food or any water, and he was heavily sedated. They'd given him over 100 milligrams in those 11 days, and he was still fighting, and no food, no water. She asked why he was naked. They said he'd tried to escape four times, so they had to cut his clothes off him. So some of the stories I've heard, and the worst thing of all, I mean, every part of that story is absolutely horrible, but the worst part of all is she managed to get his hospital notes, his medical notes, after he died. He died in her arms when he was injected. And in the hospital notes, she saw that he was given more midazolam and more morphine in the 2 days after he died.
Wow. So he was still on mechanical ventilation, maybe? And they
No.
Just after he died.
Was not. Yeah. And I said to her, why do you think that is? Because I've obviously got some ideas. And she said, I don't even want to think about it.
Oh, God.
So we didn't discuss it any further. But she screamed at them, you've killed him. And she said she can't remember much about the rest of that evening. But he was a 54-year-old man who'd gone into hospital with a chest infection, and a big man who was trying to escape. And they basically took his clothes off him and sedated him so he couldn't get out of the bed.
And they want us to believe, Jackie, and this was all the hysteria at the time, that these people were struck down with the most deadly virus known to man, COVID-19, yeah, the novel coronavirus. And this is what it does. It takes healthy 50-year-old men, athletic build, healthy, otherwise no comorbidities. And suddenly, just like that, they had to be put on a ventilator and they died. And we were meant to swallow that story whole. And the numbers just racked up, and no one questioned it, because the nurses, they'd interview the nurses and they say, oh, well, we put him on a vent and his vitals started dropping, and so we had to O2 levels started dropping, so we just kept him on the vent. And that they don't talk about what they're injecting him with, that might be the cause of the fact their vitals are plummeting.
Exactly. And well, these particular drugs used together, they cause a depression of the respiratory system to the point of death. So your breathing just slows down gradually over the period of time. So you might go down to 12 breaths, then down to 6 per minute, and then down to 3.
And they're saying that's COVID. You remember all these reports that nurses are coming on Twitter and saying, I've never seen anything like this. The O2 levels are dropping, and they're not even considering. Is it a case that even people in the healthcare setting or in the NHS setting are so caught up in the crisis that they themselves don't realize what they're doing? They think they're following emergency protocols. I mean, they're on the frontline level. I know on the administrative level, it's a different story. But do you think that's part of it?
Well, one of the sections of the film, in A Good Death, it was very easy to make it into sections because everybody I interviewed, they were all saying the same thing. And there were all these sort of things that they're all, and it was almost like I'd prompted them or something, but I actually hadn't. I just let them talk. And when we reviewed the footage afterwards, we thought, well, they're all saying this and they're all saying that. And one of the things was the cruel, sadistic and robotic nurses and doctors, right? Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not saying all medical staff, doctors and nurses are like that, but it seemed in these situations, these people dealing with them, the medics, had zero empathy. They were cruel beyond belief. They were absolutely, like, deliberately sadistic, which sounds absolutely unbelievable. But all the people I've interviewed have pretty much said the same thing, that the nurses were cold. And it made me wonder if these people had been deliberately employed for these very characteristics, you know, that they've actually actively, before the pandemic, had employed psychopaths to carry out these killings and these cullings, because your average nurse, a nice, kind, empathetic person, would not be able to do that. So who are these people, you know, who are these murderers in nurses' uniforms that have come along and followed orders to the point of killing people? I'm sure a lot of them knew exactly what they were doing. And they were being paid to do it, and probably being paid quite well. But obviously not all doctors and nurses are like that. But I think that over this last few years, a very large number, from what I've heard, have been not like your average nurse. Same with the police, you know. We saw a lot of psychopathic police behaviour as well over the last 3 years, especially at the protests. And I'm sure, you know, the friendly English Bobby was never like that. You know, I actually met some of these police officers face to face, and they're like RoboCop. You know, they're like over 6'4" and in these black uniforms and these helmets and these batons, and they were psychopaths. So I know that for a fact, because I met them face to face. My dad was in and out of hospital for a bit, and I must say I met some really lovely hospital staff, you know, absolutely lovely people. And there's probably a set of lovely nurses as well who are, think they're doing the right thing. I think the paramedics who are with my dad when he died suddenly, but they were young. They were like the girl, the female paramedic was 21. I looked her up. And I think they're trained to believe that they're putting people out of their misery, mercy killings, and that they're doing the right thing and it's kind.
I think there's an element in the institutional hierarchy that's probably definitely producing that outcome. You know, and the government framed this as a war against the virus, and the NHS went into wartime mode. And then there's no room for any compassion, no room for staff asking questions or having second thoughts. Those people would immediately be pushed out, pushed to the side, or taken off the front line and be pushing paper or something, because they're not willing to do, quote, what it takes to win this war, right? That's a big problem. I think the police as well, it's good that you brought that up, because, there's no room for the sensitive community Bobby in that setup, unfortunately.
No, not at all.
So it's pretty horrific all the way around. And the last thing I was going to ask you was, and I think this is also a key point here. So, you know, and you being a journalist, and this speaks to the issue that we started off the conversation with, you know, the Liverpool care pathway, that controversy from, like, say, 2009 to 2012, it only pushed back eventually, as you rightly pointed out, in 2014, is because of the uproar. And it was the result of journalists covering the story. If journalists had not covered the story, I don't think that policy would have just gone and increased and become more sophisticated and grown and become more accepted at the institutional level. So you taking this story, which is essentially the same story, but in a different context, in a different time, and it's now being rejected by editors, by newspapers, by mainstream media outlets. And so you have to ask the question there, are these institutions, are governments, are these media outlets, are they, you can't have a functioning democracy if you don't have a functioning fourth estate press. You just can't.
Yeah.
And well, so your final thoughts, we just got a couple minutes left, but I'll give you the floor.
I was going to say the very first story I pitched to the mainstream papers, I sent it to a broadsheet, and it was about DNRs, which we haven't really had time to discuss. Because I found out that my dad was in a care home, he had a DNR on him, and I questioned it. And then it gave rise to me looking into that further. I spoke to a whistleblower doctor who told me the truth about DNRs. This newspaper said, yeah, we'll run that story. I gave it to them, and then they sat on it for a few weeks. I said, well, what's happening with that story? They said, oh, we're not going to run it, but they wouldn't tell me why. So I got it published again with an alternative news site, and you can find that out there. It's on News Punch, but a lot of people saw that story, and it's basically talking about DNRs being put on everyone over 60, on disabled people, on children who are autistic, and not just on terminally ill people. And also the main crux of that was they were being put on people without any permission, no consent. So no consent from the patient, no consent from their family. And so that was the first shocking story. That didn't get run anywhere. 2 years later, the editor got back to me and said, oh, we're quite interested in doing something on DNRs now. And they did start to run a few little stories, but they still wouldn't touch the euthanasia COVID death pathway story. And that I can see that headline in my mind's eye, COVID death pathway. Maybe next year they'll run it. But by then, thousands more people have been killed on this death pathway. So
the damage is done. Yeah, the damage has already been done. You're absolutely correct. And, you know, Listen, I think if they had run that story at the beginning and had run it properly nationally, we wouldn't be talking about this so much right now.
No, we really
wouldn't. And that's the bottom line. But look, we're gonna break here top of the hour. Jackie, give us a shout out of the crowdfunding sites where people can support your work and anything else that you want to give a shout out to.
Well, you can see A Good Death on Iconic Media. And the new film that I'm in the middle of making at the moment, the filming's complete. We need to do the editing. It's called Playing God. It's about medical democide in the UK over the last 50 years. I'm crowdfunding that one. So I need to raise some more funds for the editing now. And if you go to Crowdfunder and look up Playing God, you'll find it there. So if we could have your support, that would be really great. That's with Trailblazer Films. And as I said, A Good Death is with Iconic Media.
Thank you, Jackie DeVoy. And we'll give a big shout out as well on at 21st Century Wire. We'll promote this project as well there. But we want to thank you for thank you for your dedication, your work on this. It's appreciated by many.
Thank you, Patrick. Thank you.
There she goes, ladies and gentlemen, as Jackie DeVoy, journalist and filmmaker. Look, top of the hour news headlines. Let's take a break here with the network. And on the other side, we'll be back with more major stories, earth-shaking geopolitics, and we'll connect with our legal correspondent at the Southern District of New York Federal Court, Matthew Lee. All this coming up. Stay right there.